Welcome, everybody, to the November call. If you are brand new group since last month, I'd particularly like to welcome you. So if you're from Morgantown, West Virginia, or Pennant Hills, Australia, or Atascocita, Texas, or Parkersburg, West Virginia, or College Park, Maryland, or Lubbock, Texas, or Panama City, Panama, first group in Central America, Fort Collins, Colorado, Castro Valley, California, Honolulu, Hawaii, Greensboro, North Carolina, Chattanooga. I know that we haven't done your group start, but we're up and functioning, so welcome to all of you who are new groups. If you're new to the call, you're working with a bunch of people who are interested in solving a very big problem, and I want to contrast solving a problem with winning an argument. If you're out to win an argument, what you're always doing is looking to see how you can gather evidence to prove the people that disagree with you are blockheads. If you're out to solve a big problem, you're not looking for that, but you're looking for what you have in common with people, so you look to see how you can include them in solving the problem rather than disagreeing with them. So what we do is we use this call to stay very focused every month. We educate ourselves. We're very excited about our speaker today. We have laser talks attached to the action sheet, so you'll have something you can practice. And then we get very focused, very concentrated action. So, for instance, this month, CCL volunteers published, when I checked last yesterday, 246 letters to the editor. So that's more letters to the editor in a month than most organizations publish in a year. And if you have a question, does your letter matter? Let me read you the note that Iwani Luti is the CCL volunteer in New York who asked Chris Gibson to introduce the Gibson Resolution, which we just added another Republican co-sponsor to this month. So congratulations, Ithaca. Getting Representative Reed on that was huge. So here's what Iona sent as a note last week. She says, as you know, we met with Chris Gibson last Friday. He reiterated how thrilled he and the other co-sponsors are over CCL support. We handed in your press packet and a big fat packet of every piece we know that we generated or tracked in New York State, 57 pieces. It looked great. Anyway, Chris is planning on significantly expanding the group of original Republican co-sponsors in the coming months. So he asks us to keep our letters to the editor coming in support of action on climate in Republican districts. So if you ever have a question, if your work is being noticed in places that we want it being noticed, it is. And so thank you for the enormous amount of effort this month. We'll get into that in more detail shortly. So in about 2 weeks, we're going to be doing a briefing on Capitol Hill. Well, we'll be meeting with a bunch of offices, doing lobby day, and then having a briefing. So what we do for our November lobby day is we take the information that we learned from over 500 Hill visits in June and go back to key members of Congress and say, this is what we know about where you are with respect to solving climate change, global warming. In conjunction with that, our esteemed economists from Resources from the Future will be doing briefings with both people from the Senate and the House on three key issues, which I'm going to ask them to talk about in just a moment. So in addition to doing the lobby day, we'll also be able to have two briefings to further broaden, further educate congressional offices about tools and consequences of pricing carbon in different ways. Now, if you've been part of this organization for a while, you know that one of the most important people that we work with on a regular basis is Shi Ling Su. And Shi Ling Su has spoken at many of our conferences. He's been the keynote speaker for our international conference. He's spoken at our regional conferences. He's been a guest on our call. And when Shi Ling Su talks about the economists from Resources from the Future, what he says to me regularly is, these are simply the best economists in Washington, D.C. So we are really glad that Rob Williams can speak today. Also, Dallas Bertrand is on the call from Resources from the Future, and we are very, very happy about that. So I'm going to ask Rob to speak about give us the short version of what he'll be briefing people on Capitol Hill about. Before that, though, there are some people who think you really can't get any meaningful reductions in emissions without using a cap as a tool. There seems to be overwhelming support from economists that a price is a more effective tool. So, Rob, before we get into what you're going to be talking about on Capitol Hill, could you just speak for a couple of minutes about why do economists generally prefer a price over a cap in terms of trying to achieve meaningful reductions? And, again, thank you so much for making yourself available on a Saturday, and particularly when you have a really young child. Welcome, Rob.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks. My wife's watching the baby in the other room, so if you hear screaming in the background, that's what's going on. The price versus quantity targeting, there are a number of things that are related to that that are aspects of a tax. So a tax is often easier to administer. It's a little simpler. But those aren't so much specifically about the price versus quantity. So let me talk about that primarily. So that difference of should we be setting a quantity target or a price target. And the main issue there is that if the way an economist looks at the problem is that we have damage that's being caused to the environment, when people are making decisions in the economy, they're not taking into account the cost that they're imposing, all that, you know, the environmental damage there. And we want them to take that into account, or at least make decisions as if they were. Now, you could do that either by putting a price on that, making them take into account the damage they're causing, internalizing externality, the jargon that we use, or you could push for that the quantity that would result from that, so just directly push down the quantity of pollution. In theory, if you know everything about the way the economy works, you can use either one of those, and either one works equally well. But if you don't know exactly how everything works, generally you want to be trying to do something that matches up, sort of puts a constraint on the economy, that matches up with the pattern that you see with the damage that's caused. So in general, if you've got a situation where a little bit more emissions cause a little bit more damage, then you want to be using a price type instrument, something that sort of gives a constant incentive. Thing where there's going to be a disaster if we go above a certain quantity, and we know where that quantity is, then a quantity type instrument can be better. You just sort of fix that below the, you know, wherever that threshold is. Now, climate change is something, there probably are thresholds, but we don't have a good idea of where those thresholds are. And as a result, it winds up looking a lot more like the case where you want the price instrument rather than the case where you've got a clear threshold you want to make sure you stay below. Layered on top of that, the year-to-year variation, if in some years we have an economic boom and in other years we've got a recession, we don't necessarily want to be keeping the same cap on emissions in all those years. So one of the things that we've seen in Europe with the EU ETS, as a result of the sort of global recession, is that the price on the EU trading certificates has gone very low. So they're not actually providing much of an incentive to reduce emissions. They set a quantity target, but it's turned out that that quantity was way too easy to meet. They should have done more. If we'd had a constant price, the way a tax would have, they would automatically have brought the emissions down further during the recession and then let them go up during, you know, hopefully the boom that will follow. You don't have that kind of flexibility with the with that kind of quantity instrument. So that's just a few reasons. It's a fairly complicated issue, but in general, that sort of flexibility and matching up better with what we know about the damage from climate change. Now, the other thing is, if you're worried about making sure we hit some particular international agreement or something like that, you can have a tax that gets adjusted. So we update the tax. If emissions are higher than we wanted them to be, we can raise the tax. If emissions are lower than we wanted them to be, we can lower the tax. You can move in a direction that's sort of something of a hybrid in between, that adjusting tax, that may be even better than, just a, you know, permanently fixed tax or a quantity instrument. So I hope that at least gives a start on an answer to that question.
No, that was fantastic, Rob. Thank you.
Yeah. So should I go ahead into the?
Yeah. Please tell us what you'll be briefing the congressional offices on.
Sure. So what I'll be talking about is two studies that we did. A whole team of researchers at Resources for the Future did and published late last year and early this year in the National Tax Journal. And these are two studies that look at how the cost of a carbon tax is distributed across income groups and across states. And a particular focus of our study was how what you do with the revenue from that tax affects that distribution. So I'm going to, you know, be talking about that, and this will be just a quick summary of that. The results come from two models that we built at RFS that we linked together for the study. So we have a model of the economy-wide effects of a carbon tax how the carbon tax and what you do with revenue is going to affect the price and quantity of a wide range of goods and services, as well as wages, returns to capital, and other things that are on the income side. Then we have a second model that takes those price and quantity changes and measures how they affect particular households. So we've got this model of the whole economy and then linked to models of individual households. I could talk a lot more about the two models, but given the limited time, I'll just leave it there. We're simulating three policy cases that are all built around exactly the same carbon tax. So the point of what we're doing is looking at the revenue recycling. So we're varying revenue recycling, keeping the carbon tax the same. What we've done is a very simple $30 a ton carbon tax held constant in real terms. So it's adjusted for inflation, but otherwise it's not changing over time. Effective immediately, no phase in, no pre-announcement or anything like that. The difference across the three cases is how the revenue is used. We model three, again, very simple cases. An across-the-board tax cut on capital income, an across-the-board tax cut on labor income, and a lump sum rebate, or what you might call a policy dividend. Again, all these are picked because they're simple, not necessarily because this is what we think ought to be done or this is what we think will be done. It's just these are simple to model and it's simple to describe the results. The real world is likely to be, you know, policy is likely to be more complex. The carbon tax will probably be pre-announced. It'll probably rise over time faster than what we're modeling. There will probably be a mix of revenue uses, but we want to model simple cases to start with. And with all of these, we're holding the deficit and government spending constant in real terms. So all we're doing is taking the carbon tax and then taking the revenue from that and either using it to cut other taxes or returning it to households via these policy dividends. The other thing to keep in mind with everything I talk about is we're just modeling the cost side. So we're not including any of the environmental benefits. When I talk about making people worse off, it's making people worse off before we take into account the fact that the environmental gains will help everybody. Again, we're just talking the cost side. All right, so into the results. The overall effect on the economy, the most efficient policy for the economy as a whole is using revenue to cut capital taxes. Cutting labor taxes is the next most efficient, and using lump sum rebate is the least efficient. And by efficient, essentially what I'm talking about is we look at the average across all households, the mean household, that's going to be best off under capital tax, worse off under the lump sum rebate. The argument there is essentially the incentives, that cutting capital taxes gives people more of an incentive to save and invest. That gives a boost to the economy. Cutting taxes on labor gives people more of an incentive to work. That gives a boost to the economy. You're not changing incentives at all with the lump sum rebate. So, but that's the average. And means can be very misleading. The story I like to tell here, if Bill Gates walks into a football stadium, the average wealth of everybody in that football stadium goes up by about $1 million. Now, does that mean that the typical person in the stadium is better off? No, it's just that there's one really, really rich guy. And so effects, you know, that are sort of very much outliers, people way in the tail of the distribution, can have a big effect on the mean, but not actually matter very much for the typical person. So suppose instead that we look at not the mean, but look at the middle quintile, so the middle 20% of the income distribution. If we look at how that quintile is affected, the ranking is completely reversed. So the three policies I just talked about, that middle quintile is best off under the rebate, worst off under the capital tax cuts, exactly the opposite of the ranking for the entire economy. And if we expand that out and not just look at the middle quintile, but look across all five quintiles from the poorest 20% of the economy all the way up to the wealthiest 20%, what you see is that the bottom three quintiles are all better off as a result of the rebate. So that rebate more than compensates them for the cost they'll face under the carbon tax. So even before you take into account any environmental benefits, that bottom 60% of the income distribution is better off. The capital tax cut is going to make the top 20% better off, but make the other four quintiles worse off. And the labor tax falls somewhere in between. It's pretty evenly distributed. Everybody's worse off, but only a little bit worse off, not a whole lot. Again, ignoring the environmental gains. So why is that? Why do we see that kind of pattern? Well, essentially, it's that the rebate is a really big deal for low-income people. If you think as a percentage of income, the kind of rebate we could give, which is somewhere in the sort of $1,500 a year per person range, that's a big deal for poor people. It's a big deal even for middle-income people. As a percentage of income, it's pretty tiny for wealthy people. So you're getting that rebate is really concentrated towards the middle, even though it's the same in dollar terms for everyone. As a percentage of income, it's a much bigger deal for people toward the bottom end. Capital income is very heavily distributed towards the top end of the income distribution, in that top 20%, and if we were to cut more finely, it would be in the top 10% or the top 5% or the top 1%. And so the capital tax cuts may be good for the economy overall, but the vast majority of that benefit is concentrated at the top of the income distribution. Okay. The other thing that's behind all this, and that isn't a major focus of our study, but it's important to keep in mind, is the effect of the carbon tax itself is not that regressive. So people think about the carbon tax as being a very regressive policy because what they think about are the direct spending on energy goods. So gasoline, natural gas, fuel oil, electricity, et cetera. And taxing those things is pretty regressive, that those all those things are a bigger percentage of income for poorer people than they are for wealthier people. But that's only part of the story with the carbon tax. So if you look, in fact, those direct energy goods are a little bit less than half of the, so consumer direct consumption of those goods, less than half of the carbon emissions in the economy. What you see being as important or perhaps even slightly more important are the indirect effects. So you buy a plane ticket, you're not directly buying energy, but you're buying something, the jet fuel gets fairly heavily taxed. You buy a set of golf clubs, you buy a new car. All these things are produced in ways that generate carbon emissions. So you get these indirect effects, the carbon tax passed through into the prices of those other products. And those indirect effects are much more evenly distributed across the economy or even slightly skewed toward wealthier people. And so if you put together the direct and indirect effects, things aren't as regressive as it looks. Add on a third thing, which is you're affecting incomes. And this is something a lot of models can't handle, but it's something, one advantage of the models we worked with. One of the things you notice is carbon-intensive industries also tend to be capital-intensive industries. So this tends to shift incomes hitting capital more than it hits labor. Well, what does that mean in terms of effects across the income distribution? That's actually a slightly progressive aspect of the tax. So layer together those things, the direct effects that are fairly regressive, the indirect effects that are pretty flat or maybe even mildly progressive, the effects on incomes that are somewhat progressive, you wind up with something where the carbon tax by itself is regressive but only pretty mildly regressive. Then start layering on what you do with the revenue, and you can easily take that mildly regressive policy and flip it and make it fairly progressive. Okay, let me move quickly on and talk about states. I don't have much time left. The differences across states are a lot smaller than the differences across incomes. So what you see is that if you look at one particular energy good, you'll see sort of clear geographic patterns. But if you start looking across all of the energy goods, things even out a fair bit. So areas that spend more on heating tend to spend less on air conditioning. And so your natural gas and heating oil goes in a different pattern than your electricity for air conditioning. Gasoline also sort of, tends to even that out. And so if we look at particular goods, you see a clear pattern. But once you sort of put together all the energy goods, and then once you additionally layer on the indirect effects, you really see something that is fairly flat across the U.S. There's some exceptions. California, for example, tends to have less energy use for a variety of reasons, climate and some of their energy policies, stuff like that. But for the most part, the differences aren't that large. And to the extent that there are some significant patterns to the differences, it's actually driven much more by incomes. So really, the fact, we see the Southeast being hit somewhat harder than some of the rest of the country. But that's, if anything, just because those people are poorer and it's sort of picking up the overall mildly regressive effect of the carbon tax rather than anything about that region specifically. Layer on the sort of what happens with recycling, that also tends to be driven mostly by incomes. So there's some exceptions. Florida does really well under capital tax recycling because there are a lot of retired people living off of capital income and stuff like that. But again, most of those differences, the differences across states are relatively small, and if anything, they're driven in part by those income differences. So to sum up quickly, sort of the key results, the carbon tax by itself, once you put together the direct effects, the indirect effects, and these effects on incomes, it's regressive, but it's only mildly regressive. It's a lot less regressive than people think. The use of the revenue is a lot more important. So you start with a carbon tax that's mildly regressive. If you do something progressive with the revenue, like a dividend, you can easily change that, you know, and make the policy progressive overall. You do something regressive with the revenue, you can make it more regressive. So that the use of what you do with the revenue is much more important than the carbon tax itself for the distributional consequences. And third, while there are significant differences across states, they're a lot smaller than the differences across income groups. Okay, thanks.
Great. Okay, fantastic. Boy, that's a lot of ground, and I think that for the people who are liaisons and other people inviting to the people to the congressional briefings, that gives them a lot of material and something that we can be really excited about inviting people. So for people, you know, we been reading papers on carbon taxation, carbon fees for a long time. People wonder, why do we advocate for a policy 100% the dividend when across the economy the tax swaps are generally considered more efficient? It's not just that it does impact the poor better off with what we have, but also we like the arguments of two of our board members. Jim Hansen says that if people don't see they're immediately dealing with increase in cost, they won't support it. And Secretary Schultz says that that's the most honest, hardest to rig solution. Okay, so I got a lot of questions, Rob, and I'm going to just give you some of the ones that I got the most often.
Sure.
One question was, you know, is there an impact on if we get what we want, which is the monthly rebate check, the dividend, will it matter if it's taxed or not? Now, we know there's consequences. So, for instance, when the CLEAR Act was introduced in 2009, they didn't tax the dividend, and so CBO scored it in a way where only 75% of the revenue could go back because they didn't tax it. So we know that there's consequences like that, but do you see much of a difference in terms of the people who get the checks? You know, we've seen multiple studies that show two-thirds of households coming out equal or better with our proposal. Will it matter much if that check is taxed or not?
So what we modeled for this study was having a tax, a dividend that's not taxed, and only rebating, you know, to the extent that this policy affects revenue from other taxes, only rebating sort of what's left over after we cover, and, you know, to the extent that this pushes up the prices of what government buys, you know, we're sort of taking some revenue out to cover those things and only rebating what's left. If we tax the dividend, it depends a little bit on then what you do with the tax revenue from that dividend. But if you think about, okay, that lets you cover these other things I just talked about, and so you can make the dividend a little bigger. You know, from a distributional standpoint, that's a little bit like poor people making the dividend a little smaller for wealthier people, but doing it in a way that you can still label it as being evenly distributed, because evenly distributed before taxes, it's just that becomes sort of slightly more progressive after taxes. So from a distributional standpoint, you know, wealthier people are in higher tax brackets, they're going to be paying more in taxes. It's just as if you're giving a smaller dividend to wealthier people, a larger dividend to poorer people. That also has incentive effects. That actually creates an incentive to work a little bit less, earn a little bit less. It's a pretty tiny incentive, but it would matter to some extent. So you'd make the policy a little bit less efficient, a little bit more progressive. I haven't modeled it here. There's some previous RFF studies that have looked at that. It makes a difference. It doesn't make a huge difference. And it goes in the direction that I just said. So sort of helping the poorer folks, making the wealthier folks worse off, overall a little bit worse for the economy, but not a big deal.
Okay, good. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
We've assumed that with any type of carbon tax, the model we want or others, that most any business who can will try and, you know, pass their costs on to their customers. But then you have state and local governments who they're going to be impacted in some way. And what do you anticipate would happen with state and local governments who probably can't pass on increased costs to their customers? So what kind of impact would we be looking at in state and local governments?
Sure. Before I answer that, let me just – one thing that you said in there, the idea that costs will be passed on to customers – one of the key things in what we did in the modeling, we did not assume that all costs are passed on to customers. We assumed that businesses will try to do that. But
yeah.
Also, some of the costs will be passed on to workers in the form of slightly lower wages, and some of the costs will be passed on to the owners of the firms in lower profits. So whether those are shareholders or whether they're owned by individuals. You're going to tend to get those passed off to somebody else. And state and local governments don't necessarily have the ability to do that. So in the modeling that we did, we just treated all government as one category. So we lumped together state, local, and federal governments. And we assumed that the government kept enough of the tax revenue to cover the extra costs that it would have. So if all the things that the government's buying are a little bit more expensive, that's covered by the tax and sort of some taken out before they rebate everything. If we have a federal carbon tax and state and local governments are paying that, then that's going to effectively be, the federal government will look better off than what our results might seem to indicate, and the state and local governments might be worse off. And that could be fairly substantial, that, our results suggest that somewhere around a quarter of the carbon tax is going to wind up getting passed on to some form of government. So either in the form of governments that have means-tested transfers or inflation-adjusted transfer programs, that the thresholds for those programs will go up if the price level goes up, or just government directly buying goods and services. And so if you did a federal carbon tax and you didn't have any transfer to state and local governments, then you really would want it to be a fairly significant budget hit for state and local governments. And so one of the things you might think about including, if you're worried about that, is including some small intergovernmental transfer. So have the federal government pay some of the money toward the states or localities, pass some of it down, in a way that sort of roughly holds them harmless. Of course, you couldn't do it exactly, and you probably wouldn't want to do it exactly because that might prevent the local governments having the incentive to cut back on their use of carbon-intensive products. But definitely some sort of transfer like that might be a way of preventing that state and local hit.
Great. Okay, well, that is an enormous amount of ground in very little time, so I'm really, really grateful that you could join us, and I'm certainly hoping that we can have you and other people back from Resources from the Future on a regular basis. That was fantastic, Rob.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and thanks to everybody on the call for taking the time out of your Saturday to listen.
Great, great, and I know you have an 11-month-old, so if you have to drop off, I certainly understand that. Dallas, if you want to stay on also for the next 10 or 15 minutes of the call, both of you are welcome, but certainly understand if you have to drop off. Okay, good. So I just want to go over a couple of things that happened since last month's call. So first of all, in Canada, as I said, as people were signing on, this was just a fantastic month in Canada. First of all, I think that Trudeau is a significant upgrade over Harper, so good work on that. We had 18 lobby meetings in Ontario, the Canadians have done a great job of getting public service announcements and had one on during the final World Series game. So I know everybody who was watching that game and heard the Citizens Climate Lobby Canada public service announcement come on, that was really, really exciting. Fresno had, last time I checked, 11 letters to the editor this month. That is just great. And again, as I said at the start of the call, the Ithaca chapter, congratulations, adding another Gibson co-sponsor. You know, between having the Gibson resolution now, and we've also got four senators who have put together a working group. We're going to be working on expanding that. That is just really coming along really nicely. Let me see if I can get Peter Brin to unmute his line for a second, because I want to talk about the Texas Energy Freedom Tour. So, Peter, first of all, could you *6 and unmute your phone for a second?
I'm here.
Okay, great. So, Peter, I'm going to just go over what happened real quick, and then if you could tell us just a little bit about what we learned from doing that much work in Texas, that would be great. So just so everybody knows, what happened is this was a 28-day tour called the Texas Energy Freedom Tour. We visited 25 cities, over 20 CCL volunteers organized the trip, 3,500-plus miles traveled, two flat tires, 24 public presentations, 14 congressional district offices, 12 Chamber of Commerce meetings, five farm bureaus, four mayors, four newspapers, three county judges, two Republican Party chairs, one radio interview, one TV year, one tabling event, two group starts, six chapters in development, 196 new volunteers, 269 handwritten postcards to members of Congress. And just so everybody knows, at the Texas Tech group start, Dr. Hayhoe spoke before the group start, stayed for the whole group start, including the practice meeting with a member of Congress and the end that we always have. So great work to everybody. And Peter, just tell us, you know, what did we learn? I mean, we targeted Texas because it's important. Now we've got a new Ways and Means chairman. But what did we learn from being on the road in Texas for a month?
Well, thanks, Mark. Yeah, so, you know, CCL is betting the farm on relationships, and that's kind of what the theme of the lessons learned that I put together are. First, I wanted to start with relationship building in our own chapters. So, you know, 20 volunteers across Texas supported this effort, and that didn't happen by accident. It happened because we had the right volunteers matched with the right activities. And that happened because, you know, we know each other's strengths amongst our volunteers. So when we put the team together, we identified who would excel at outreaching to different groups and asked those volunteers directly to take on those roles. So the result was that almost all of the volunteers we approached said yes, and collectively, as you mentioned, they scheduled over 75 events. So the first thing I'd like to point out is, you know, how strong relationships within our own chapters really just made us more effective at getting this thing going. Second, relationship building with community leaders. So, you know, we were going in to talk with all the community leaders that you mentioned on a topic that for some is distant, for others is even hostile. So building that common ground right from the start was really critical to winning over these audiences. You can talk about anything when you walk in. You can talk about a memento you see on the wall, or, you know, Ricky, who was with us, would often start picking on the person's favorite football team and get into a friendly sports rivalry. Down here in oil and gas country, we, you know, mentioned that three of us worked in petrochemicals before. So, you know, now common ground or not, some folks just have a knee-jerk reaction when you hear the words climate change. That's unavoidable. But what we want to avoid is getting into an I'm right, you're wrong discussion. So, you know, the best example of this that we really had kind of a breakthrough that the CCL messaging worked was we did met with a county judge. He was a big guy, former Marine, strong personality, and one of the first things he said was windmills kill birds and consume more energy than they put out. So we didn't engage. Instead, we bit our tongues and said, you know what, you're right. If windmills kill birds, they should be held accountable. We believe all fuels should be held accountable. And we really got the discussion back on point. So, you know, in your meetings, avoid the landmines and focus on common ground, because what's important is building relationships, not always, you know, being right. And the final thing I would just say on relationship building is with your audiences. So 25 of the events we had were public presentations. And the PowerPoint that we put together built on the Bob Perkowitz model. Now, those of you who were in D.C. this year might remember Bob Perkowitz spoke on climate messaging. And some of the key things he pointed out were, first of all, start and end with people, acknowledge ambivalence, offer solutions, and some of the other standard CCL messaging bits. So we started with people by opening the presentation talking about why Texas is so important in this discussion, and we focused on, you know, why is climate change a people issue, and yes, it's a polar bear issue, but let's focus on the people aspect. And that seemed to get a lot of reaction from the audiences. People seemed to follow us pretty closely. So there's a lot of other things I could point out, but I think, you know, we learned a lot about the relationship building, and I think that the CCL messaging motto was pretty well validated on the trip.
Great. And so the last thing I saw in your note is about the Texas Energy Freedom Tour is there's a good chance we're going to do again next year. Is that right?
Well, like we said, we're relationship building, and that was something that we learned pretty quickly is this is probably just the beginning. So, yeah, there may well be a second tour. So I got a few extra spare tires in my car.
Yeah. Great, Peter. Thanks so much. All right, fantastic, absolutely fantastic. I know we were all excited while it was happening, and then just to get the summary, what extraordinary work by everybody there. Lene Pettengill, could you get your phone live for just a second?
I'm here.
Okay, good. And so part of the on the action sheet people will see is our year-end appeal is beginning, and could you just tell us a little bit about what's going to be happening with that?
Sure. We are hoping to bring in $200,000 with our year-end appeal. This money covers some of the infrastructure necessary to support all of our incredible volunteers in the field, as you do amazing work to move us forward to a significant, effective climate solution. As part of our appeal on Giving Tuesday, which is December 1st, the first Tuesday after Thanksgiving, it's kind of an antidote to the shopping frenzy of Black Friday, we have an incredible $25,000 matching grant available. So if you or your contacts give on that day, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $25,000. So you might want to make a little note in your calendar, and we will also be sending you an email on that day. If you want to reach out to your contacts to ask them if they'd like to support our work, you can share with them the link that's listed in today's action sheet. And there's also a sample note you can draw from. So I hope you'll donate December 1st or anytime now until the end of the year. And thank you, everyone, for your donations and your help fundraising.
Great. Thanks for your extraordinary leadership on this issue. I think people know that we keep CCL funded to a bare-bones staff just so that we can maintain the level of support that we have to make sure that everything is happening in the field, like the Texas tour, like Ithaca getting a new co-sponsor for Gibson, so that like 246 letters to the editor. Speaking of which, Amy Bennett, could you get your phone live for just a second so we can report on what's happened since last month?
Yes, Mark, can you hear me?
Yeah. So are there any statistics that kind of jump out at you this month?
Yes, there are, Mark. I wanted to mention that we have supporters now in all but one district across the United States. So we're looking for some help to find folks in Mississippi, the first district. That's in Tupelo, Mississippi, kind of the northern part of Mississippi. But just great news that we've got this much coverage.
Well, that's great. So the first step is to have a supporter so we can get a meeting with every member of Congress, and then the next step is to make sure there's an active, growing chapter in every single community. So that's great. What else, Amy?
Well, what we pushed some figures, looked at some figures, and we see that now we have 13 states where we have at least as many groups as there are congressional districts, and then also we have 21 states where we have 1 to 2 districts left to go where we need a group.
Great. What else?
As you mentioned earlier, I think we had 246 letters to the editor, but that puts us at a total so far this year of 2,186 letters to the editor for the year. And then we also have 339 op-eds, which already exceeds last year's total.
Wow. Okay. All right. Amy, thank you for reporting that, and everybody for all the effort of everything that happened with letters, meetings. Thank you so much. And again, just like Representative Gibson said in his note that Iona Luddy reported on, it's making a difference with people that we needed to make a difference. Okay, so what are we doing this month? Well, in Canada, we have a new PM, so we're asking everybody to write Mr. Trudeau and ask him to have Canada adopt carbon fee and dividend on a net national basis. You know, there's so much work in the provinces now. We want to get him focused on a national basis. And then we have new MPs or returning MPs, and we would like you to lobby them. What we're going to be doing in the U.S. is, as Lene started, we're starting our fall, our year-end appeal. We're going to ask everybody also to contact your senator. So if your senator is one of the four that's part of the working group, to thank them for showing leadership. If they're a Republican, to join the working group. If they're a Democrat, to thank the Republicans for showing leadership on this issue. And then after 246 letters to the editor, which is just a monster month, we want to beat that again this month. And given we should start to see more and more news about Paris in the papers, use every opportunity that you see about climate talks, anything, particularly Paris, but anything to make sure that we continue to get a huge amount of presence in the papers. Also, there are a lot of people going to Paris, and I'm just very appreciative of that, of the effort that Joe Robertson is leading at pathwaytoparis.org, pathwaytoparis.org.com. Really, there's two things we're focused on. One is working to try and get language about transparent pricing into the negotiations, and two, the other side of CCL, which is to have citizen engagement be a big part of the process.